The only thing better than grinding all night for your side hustle is your roommate picking you up with Mickey D's breakfast. The perfect pickup deal.
There's a deal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, taste breakfast perfection when you get a warm and savory sausage McMuffin with egg for just $2.50. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Live by Live has all of your favorite music, and you can listen for free. Whether you hit play on one of our hundreds of curated music stations or create your own custom artist radio station, you'll find the music you love on Live by Live. Visit LiveXLive.com or search LiveXLive in the App Store or Google Play and listen for free now.
Look, staying healthy isn't easy. Watching your diet, hitting the gym, avoiding stress. But a good night's rest helps boost your overall health and wellness. And it couldn't be easier. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed effortlessly adjusts in response to both of you. The result? You wake up ready for anything. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. Don't miss our weekend special. Save up to $1,000 on Sleep Number 360 smart beds. Plus special financing. Ends Monday. Special financing subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. See store for details.
Hey everyone, welcome to Radical Musings. This episode is pretty special to me because I get to speak with Ronan Farrow. Ronan Farrow, who was one of the people to expose Harvey Weinstein and the horrific crimes against women, sexual assaults that happened through the years that he uncovered for a few years and tried to break the story at NBC. And, you know, he's got this great book, Catch and Kill, which tells the whole story about how this all came into fruition from the people that were courageous enough to come forward and tell their stories, like Rose McGowan and Emily Nussbaum and so many wonderful actors, Mira Savino and Ashley Judd, and there's so many. I can't even Annabella Shora. And I'm in there. You know, we all had a story to tell that was hard, and he did it. And yeah, we're still living with it. We went into quarantine. Harvey Weinstein did end up going to jail, which was kind of unheard of. And I think we were all actually really surprised by it because it didn't look like it was going to go that way, even though it was scary. Anyway, it happened on March 11th. And then the 13th, we went into quarantine in March. So it's been quite a year, I got to tell you. He wrote Catch and Kill about the experience, and it reads like a spy thriller. It's so amazing. Seriously, I mean, you would not believe what he endured to make this story see the light of day and that Harvey was ultimately held accountable. His personal journey is also intriguing. He's the son of celebrities Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. He saw his family ripped apart by scandal over allegations Allen molested Ronan's sister, Dylan. He skipped high school, and he started college at age 11. Do you hear that, everybody? He skipped high school and started college at the age of 11. He was going to Yale Law School at 18. We're talking beyond intelligent, brilliant. He really is. When you say genius, and people misuse that word all the time, he actually is a genius. Yet he's also got this incredible sense of humanity and integrity. And that's why I trusted him to tell my story about Weinstein. We just passed the year anniversary of the Weinstein trial. And, you know, I can't believe a year has passed. But one thing we know for sure, it wouldn't have happened without Ronan Farrow. Check out our conversation.
How are you?
Fantastic.
Are you away? Are you in another? You're in the country.
At my mom's place. She sends love.
Okay, good. I was hoping could she come and say hi later?
Yeah, I'll ask her.
Yeah, I would love to say hi to her. In fact, I should do a separate thing with her only.
I'm sure she'd be delighted to. She's great, and I want you guys to both be working coming out of the pandemic.
Oh, Ronan, I just had a great job. That was one of those.
Yay!
It was a great job with a great producer, a great creator. I'll tell you later. I don't want to say it on here. And then 11th hour, somebody at the top got rid of me.
No. God damn it.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we got to find new stuff.
But the thing we're learning together.
Oh,
I would love nothing more. Especially working with your mom. I would love to do something with your mom. Ronan, what are you up to? What's going on?
I just put out a new story about a whistleblower revealing some important things and getting terribly retaliated against by the Trump administration, including Gina Haspel, who still currently runs the CIA. So you should link people to that, and you should take a look at that. You'd be interested in it. And if there are any other whistleblowers out there, call me. You know, I think it's such an important issue to protect people who make principled disclosures and keep our government accountable.
And boy, do we need to keep this government accountable.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, as they're trying to pardon everybody as they leave us and, you know, burning in flames. But
I mean, it's an extreme situation. And that's part of what the piece gets into, that, you know, the situation was bad for whistleblowers under Obama and it got much, much worse under Trump. And it's much more brazen. You know, Trump is like firing people associated with the impeachment proceedings right, left and center. There's been a double down on prosecutions of whistleblowers at the Department of Justice under the Espionage Act. It's really extreme and really bad. But, you know, like I said, the baseline that we started from coming out of the Obama administration was not great either. Obama set a new record for prosecuting officials accused of leaking government information, many of whom, you know, human rights groups consider to be principled whistleblowers. So we've got to keep an eye on the Biden administration on that issue. We've got to see what his Department of Justice does. And, you know, is he going to pardon reality winner? Is he going to continue the prosecution of Daniel Hale?
I hope so. I would think that Kamala would. I mean, if, you know, she has anything to say about it.
I don't know. You know, some of these, Daniel Hale, who I just mentioned, who was the allegedly the source of the Intercept's reporting on drones during the Obama administration. So those were, you know, important disclosures that I think created some accountability around a pretty unaccountable program. He's about to start trial sort of in this interregnum between administrations. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, the Biden administration, whoever is at DOJ, when someone gets in there, considers it worth their while to pump the brakes, or if they think it's too late. You know, it's kind of a bipartisan problem, Rosanna, that we don't protect whistleblowers, and protecting whistleblowers has been something that, you know, American leadership has talked about and spoken to the importance of since the founding fathers. Very early in our history, we talked about people who know about government malfeasance should blow the whistle about it.
Well,
so I hope people take a look at that story and take a look at that issue, because it kind of, you know, went out during the election mania, and all anyone could pay attention to was the horse race of the vote counts coming in. But God, if we want to have an accountable government, we've got to do better on these whistleblower issues.
Are you comfortable with the Biden administration? I have to say, he wasn't my first choice because of where we've been at. And maybe it's because it's been so horrible to just have any kind of decency. We're suffering from PTSD.
Well, look, you and I have very different roles in this. You know, you're a wonderful activist, and it's great that you're outspoken in the way you are. I really, to preserve the integrity of the work, go to pains to be nonpartisan. You know, I'm registered as an unaffiliated voter, and you know, different journalists have a whole bunch of different approaches to whether they vote, which races they vote in. You know, Jake Tapper and others have spoken about, you know, they only vote in some elections, ones that they're not covering. I think Anderson Cooper and others have spoken to not voting at all. Everyone lands in a different place, but for my part, you know, I don't register with a specific party, and sincerely, I don't feel an allegiance to a specific party. That said, you know, there's some truth, I think, to what you say that transcends the usual nonpartisanship. I think that this administration took steps to try to demonize the free press and to, you know, crack down on basic freedoms that transcend party politics. You know, I do not think it is partisan or inappropriate for journalists to defend the importance of journalism. And to say that it's inappropriate for presidents to use sort of authoritarian rhetoric about the press, describing the press as the enemy of the people. So, you know, that's just taking one issue where I do think that we've lived through an extreme that, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, should be troubling. And indeed, many of my conservative friends are privately very troubled by it.
You have a lot of conservative friends?
I do.
You do?
I have a lot of conservative friends, both in the media and outside the media.
What do you think of the, I mean, the Steve Schmidt's a very smart man, you know, and I actually respect a lot of what he's been talking about. He was Republican and he's brought the Lincoln Project and all the people that have been involved with that. I think it's good that they did that. And
yeah, I've talked to Steve and, you know, I think he represents a pretty significant constituency where, again, the usual rules of party lines don't apply when something this extreme happens.
So you're talking about whistleblowers and being retaliated against. I am one of those whistleblowers, one of the people that came out about Harvey Weinstein and incredible work that you did uncovering this. I've just told so many people, there's still a lot of people that haven't heard. I said, you really got to get Ronan reading his book, To Catch and Kill, and then listen to the whole podcast about it. It's just it'll keep you, busy and entertained, thinking during COVID. It's a good time to listen to it.
I hope it's both. You know, I think even the toughest stories can be entertaining. You know, you and many other people in that story are naturally charismatic and entertaining, you know, even when you're talking about the darkest possible things. So I think all of the shades of emotion are there in that story. And I was really lucky to be able to tell it. And I was lucky that you helped me tell it along with a bunch of other sources who really had to go through hell and had a lot of doubts about whether they should be taking that risk. And I hope you feel like it was worth it in the end.
Yes, I do think it was worth it. Absolutely. Why did it take a bunch of Hollywood actresses and your story coming out for people to actually listen? When we had the Cosby women, we had so many people had come out before in cases like this with powerful men and saying, you know, they were assaulted by a powerful man. And it took this group for some reason, for it to become this kind of news. And then the best part of it for me is Tarana Burke's work has gone to the level that it has around the world. And for that, I feel really happy about.
Isn't she the best? I mean, it's such a learning experience just being around her and spending time with her, which I've had the privilege to do as we've sort of spoken around the country and stuff before the pandemic. And, you know, really she became a friend after all that reporting came out and I came to understand more deeply the significance of her work in the years beforehand. She, on top of everything else, is someone who really embodies what we were talking about before, where there's the full spectrum of emotions in her. And she's actually as fun as any human being I've ever interacted with. You know, she is a blast. And, you know, despite the fact that she personally has been through stuff that, you know, might break a lot of us and spends a lot of her time working on such dark issues, you know, she's a real lesson in sort of maintaining her light too, not just survival, but surviving with such kind of panache. You know, she really stays buoyant in the face of all of that. And, you know, I think that's just her being an incredibly strong person and someone who knows
has worked on her healing.
I mean, I'm sure that's taken work for her.
It is, and that's what she's taught to so many, like to be in the power of your truth. And once you've done that, it's a powerful thing. It's not something to most people who, and we've witnessed it and we know these people who come out with their truth and they spiral into the dark place. And that's what you're saying is that she doesn't do that. It's yes, you're right. She's such a wonderful woman.
And to be clear, there's, you know, we both know people who, I think you've used the phrase like an aura of darkness, you know, coalesces around them because they've been through a lot of dark things. And I have nothing but boundless sympathy for those people. And it's not like we can expect everyone to be, you know, a bubbly fun time all the time as they deal with trauma. That said, I think, you know, it is really, as I go through low moments in life, it's really helpful to spend time with someone like Tarana who just maintains such strength and grace through it all and such resistance to going to that all-consuming dark place.
How are you? Okay, so because this is, you know, so cliche that how are you doing during the pandemic? But you also, because it's been so challenging for every relationship, for parents, for you know, having to school their children online all day, these poor kids on Zoom all day. It's just, it's too much. It's overwhelming and it's a lot. And I know for me and my relationship, oh my God, we've gone through like ups and downs and it's been challenging. How are you doing with John? How are you guys? Is John, is he using his heavy blanket, that weighted
blanket? Yeah, I got him a weighted blanket. He hasn't really been using the weighted blanket, though maybe he should. It's a stressful time for everyone. It's funny, you know, you mentioned the obligatory kind of preamble to every conversation we have now in this time where it's sort of hard to avoid cliches. You know, how are you doing in this terrible, strange time? You know, we've said it a million times at the beginning of calls, but it is sincere. I hope you and your family are hanging in there, Rosanna. You know, I probably, like you, feel really privileged to be able to, you know, make ends meet and do much of my work from home. And, you know, I'm not having to go in and be a server in a restaurant every day.
We are so privileged.
Right. A million other jobs where people really do have to take risks every day. You know, I'm not a frontline healthcare worker. You know, there's a lot of people who, you know, I think we've all got to really root for and pray for right now. And not everyone has the luxury that we've had of, you know, being able to do podcasts and interviews and reporting from home. My job still has the usual ups and downs, which can feel very extreme emotionally sometimes, of like every story I do entails all kinds of crazy threats and smears. And, you know, that's an occupational hazard, and it's one I feel fortunate to be able to shoulder. It's part of the job, but it can be fatiguing. And I think if you couple that with, you know, being closed in and having, a lot of privilege in terms of how I've been able to weather the pandemic, but also a lot of obstacles to the work I do. You know, I can't meet up with sources and get.
So are you doing your HBO? Yeah. Do you have a deal with HBO?
Yeah, I'm doing HBO investigative documentaries. And
really?
I've been really lucky to partner with some incredible.
I've got a couple of stories for you.
Oh, please. Well, I do. Rosanna, what people might not know about Rosanna Arquette is she is a font of leads, because boy, do you ever have an ear to the ground. You know, there's been a couple of times when you've called and said, you're not going to believe this, but, and it's turned into a really significant story. I'm always on the hunt for more to do.
There's stuff to talk about for sure. I think we're in just such a crazy, I will. I'm going to talk to you about stuff.
The documentaries have been a wonderful way to partner with some great creative people. And the HBO documentary team is just first rate. You know, they like the team I work with at The New Yorker, have kind of built into their DNA just taking every risk necessary to get good reporting out. You know, they've tangled with the Church of Scientology. They've done all of these, you know, they did this NXIVM documentary recently. They've gone up against potent and litigious adversaries to tell important stories. And, you know, I feel fortunate that I've been able to land with partners who have that attitude towards journalism. And, you know, I think it's a little premature to talk about the specific topics, but I'm working on one with that's probably going to come first, that we're headed into edit in now soon, with Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady, a wonderful pair of filmmakers of Loki Films. You should check out all their work. They did a great documentary called Jesus Camp.
Jesus Camp, yes.
Yeah, they're just fantastically talented. So it's been cool, you know, carefully doing shoots in the time of COVID, everything distanced, everyone tested.
You're actually going, you're out there. So you are in the field, you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's important to me that these be stories that are about the stories, not about me. So in some of these cases, I'm, you know, not the most important or central element, thank God. But I
think you have to be careful when you come home, especially with your mom.
Absolutely. And I've been particularly careful because, you know, anyone over the age of 50, who has a history of lung issues, which my mom does,
me too.
You know, is really vulnerable. You got to stay careful, Rosanna.
I know. I have asthma. I get it's scary.
We can't let you get it. You know,
I don't want to get COVID. I lost three people and it's a terrible way to go. And then yesterday, I guess it was Alyssa or somebody showed the picture of the hospital stands of iPads all standing there for people's goodbyes. Mm. It was too much.
It's really, really, you know, more than anyone should have to bear. And I'm keeping in my thoughts everyone who has gone through that. I have one sister who was briefly hospitalized with COVID, but is doing okay now.
Any long-term effects? Anything?
You know, we don't know yet. You know, we're keeping an eye on her medical situation. She's been okay up until very recently. Maybe something's happening now.
Is that Coretta's mom?
That's Coretta's mom, Quincy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, young and healthy, thankfully, and I think we'll be fine. But obviously not everyone has been so fortunate as to have the relative affected be one who is probably going to be capable of weathering it. So all of that, you know, does create a psychological weight, Rosanna. It's, you know, I wish I could tell you I've been like blithely happy during all of this. I've felt it. And while I'm very conscious of how fortunate I've been, it's been a, you know, a destabilizing and difficult year.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have tried to put work in on my mental health that I haven't done before through a couple of years of moving very, very fast, through very, very, very stressful situations where I've been really embattled. You know, all of the kinds of threats I talked about in Catch and Kill and that you knew about and were part of. And, you know, that is, as I said, kind of a baseline of my professional existence, but it takes a toll over time for sure.
Of course. So can you tell me, because I remember you telling me, or was your mother told me, that you had gotten in college, all these colleges at 11 years old. Do you mind talking a little bit about your childhood? Was it Columbia University or somebody, and you were 11?
I ended up
you're too young, you can't go.
Columbia was one of the places that I considered, and they were wonderful there. But in the end, I think correctly, my mom was the one who thought, A, she wanted an easier commute because I was going to have to be driven to class for the first 2 years at that age. And then B, you know, I think she wisely gravitated towards putting me in a smaller setting given my age. So I wound up at Bard, which was a fantastic experience.
But you did get into Harvard. You got into, could you tell me the schools you got into at 11 years old?
I don't even remember the list of places. I know that Columbia
but
was
like,
kind of
it was
runner-up.
Columbia, it was Yale.
I went to Yale for law school. And which was also, by the way, the same kind of principle of, by then I took 2 years off in between. So I was 18 by the time I started at Yale, but, it was a fantastic experience for me being a lot younger than the other law students, partly because it's a tiny place, Yale Law, you know, it's a sensitive, it's like the Montessori school of law schools. It's, you know, a collection of kind of often eccentric people with interesting life stories that you can learn a lot from, and everybody knows each other. And it's a little bit, you know, people joke when they're there, like being back in high school, which, you know, I can only speculate since I didn't graduate from high school. But that was kind of my high school, and what a wonderful thing.
Did you just went directly to college?
I went direct. I took high school classes at a local high school during middle school. I skipped, what was it, 7 grades. So I did everything kind of out of sequence and at the wrong time. And you, fair listeners, and Rosanna Arquette will have to be the judge of how socially dysfunctional it's made me.
No, but I love, you know what I love is that your mom, we have to, you know, if people don't know that Ronan's mom is Mia Farrow, the great Mia Farrow, great actress, beautiful, incredible actor. And that she recognized, you know, in all her kids, but to Bard, which was far from Connecticut. I mean,
yeah,
it's
for the first
like
2 years, and then I lived on campus with a professor for the last 2 years. But for the first two, when I was really a baby, she, God bless her, drove me along with a couple of friends. My godmother Casey, who's the most wonderful person, did a lot of driving as well. So people kind of came together to keep an eye on me during that phase, and I really inflicted it on them. I mean, my mom was wonderful to go along with it, but I was like the helicopter parent, you know, or I was my own stage mom. My mom's input was always to kind of say, hey, you sure you don't want to be just in normal grade school and couldn't you have fun that way? But I would like to say that it was sincerely just intellectual curiosity. And I think that was a big part of it. I was bored with grade school work, and I was having such a blast with the college courses. I was very fortunate to be able to do, Johns Hopkins has a program where you can take college classes early during the summer. So I started doing that. And I was reading a lot, and I think a lot of it was genuine curiosity, but I'm sure, you know, if I'm going to armchair psychologize myself, there's also like just a bottomless well of insecurity that I'm constantly filling where I needed to be, you know, the best at all the things.
Do you feel that was because you have like a lot of brothers and sisters? So you were all this a huge, huge family because your mother's a beautiful activist. She adopted many, many children.
Yeah, I really admired that she, what she did with the family. And, you know, it was very inspiring being around and loving people who had a much harder lot in life than I did. You know, a lot of my siblings have significant physical disabilities and mental health issues. And, you know, that can be punishing to grow up around in some ways. You know, these were not like issues that went away. You know, it was pretty tumultuous over the course of my entire life. But also I really got to see people surmount great obstacles and show a lot of strength. So that's something I've always learned from.
Can we talk about Dylan? And she has a new book. You grew up with your father at the time, Woody Allen, and your sister, this is a very famous case, was molested by him, and that your mother's fierce warrior nature protecting her child, fiercely coming out against that, affected her whole career.
Yeah.
I admire her for it. We all do. You know, anybody who's human being. So tell me how you navigated that as a kid with when that was going on.
Well, it's a case that, you know, everyone has heard about now for a generation, and I think are probably tired of hearing about. But what you say is also a larger truth, and I think it's important to remember that the kinds of tactics you're talking about, the kind of destroy the mother as a proxy when you have a victim who, you know, my sister's a 30-something-year-old woman now, and she has always consistently maintained her story. And you know, I won't go down this rabbit hole now, but if you really look at the court records and
you just read the judge, you have to do is read what he says and it's all there.
It's chilling. It really is a case where, you know, and I've had this conversation with, sex crimes prosecutors and forensic experts and stuff who have similarly done a deep dive on those documents and come to the same conclusion. It really does appear that, you know, he got away with it. And I don't think that would have happened now. I think that there was a lot of manipulation of the process. I mean, crazy stuff.
And the press.
Yeah, I mean, there was a New York social worker investigation where one of their top ranked, most respected social workers concluded that my sister was credible and consistent in her allegation, and the mayor's office ordered him to change his finding. It was that was in the media and stuff at the time, and everyone is kind of.
And who was the mayor at the time?
He just died. I'm forgetting his name. Okay. Dinkins?
It was Dinkins.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a bummer.
It is a bummer.
Damn.
But, you know, it was a case where that guy has always maintained that was his finding, and he faced a pretty significant retaliation campaign as a result of it. Gloria Steinem, interestingly, as a journalist, was one of the people who covered that story initially. And has been pretty outspoken in saying like there was corruption here. But that's all, you know, a sidebar. I think the wider truth is a lot of the tactics that you see in that case are old fashioned tactics that have been discredited and people should be wary of in other cases too. You know, you have a credible victim maintaining their story into adulthood. Well, let's blame the mother. It's got to be a disgruntled mother. That is, it shows up in so many custody cases, so many abuse cases.
In the Weinstein case, it's the same thing. They did the same thing. The dirty tactics, right?
Dirty tactics. And just, you know, specifically in, you know, cases involving children, blame the mother is like the oldest tactic in the book. And just, you know, the numbers show you it's just not a thing that's usually true. You know, it's something I think people should be really leery of. And similarly, you know, the whole concept, which really was elevated in the zeitgeist by the Woody Allen case of parental alienation. If you actually look at the literature around parental alienation, it was pioneered by a really crazy discredited character with a lot of misogynistic and other problematic views. You know, the numbers that we do have in terms of actual research into, does this actually happen, that kids can be completely brainwashed where they maintain stories for decades and decades? It really can. You don't get a brainwashed kid to make up a story like that. It's like just the most infinitesimally small percentage of cases where there's any evidence of that kind of, you know, that you can coach a whole fact pattern into a child's mind. It just, it doesn't exist. So it's a crutch that gets used.
Text I sent you the other day about that person to talk to. Mm. I want you to talk
to the person. Okay. Yeah.
About this subject.
Well, I'll do that. And in any case, it's, you know, it reveals a lot of discredited tactics that I hope fall by the wayside now that we have a greater understanding of these issues, and a lot of manipulations of justice systems that I hope are also a thing of the past now that people are sort of hearing victims and women more, I hope.
Well, I just also want to say that Dylan has written a book called Hush, which is really good. That could be turned
into... She's a beautiful writer.
Yeah.
And she's working on the sequel now.
Could be could turn that into a major motion picture.
Yeah, let's set it up. Let's get you in it. It's, you know, she's so talented. And one of the things I wrote about in Catch and Kill is how she, partly because she'd been through all of this, I think really had a struggle coming to a place where she could fully embrace her talents and her voice. And it's wonderful to see her doing that.
Well, you see so many women who they want to tell their story, and then a lot of people spin out. And that's what we're talking about, Tarana. She sticks with her light, but it is an empowering thing to be able to speak your truth. And then there is something that comes along with it that can be from abusive from other people towards you. I know I have a lot of friends that we know and, you know, who defends him to the death, and I've kind of lost friendships over it.
Well, I really respect that about you. You know, I've had... people for a long time sort of looked the other way. And I think that is emblematic of the broader treatment of sexual abuse issues in Hollywood and beyond. And it was always striking, you know, the people who long before the Me Too movement came to the prominence that it's come to in the last few years came up and said really principled, kind of at the time, countercultured things to me. I mean, of course, you were someone who always took a principled stand on this sort of thing. You know, Jane Fonda, who's been ahead of the curve on so many issues. There's this great old clips about her talking about gay rights and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, she, going back years and years, had said to me, I don't even know her that well, but made a point of coming up to me and saying, I have refused to do Woody Allen movies. I would not do it. You know, this is a stance of principle. People who looked into it, I think particularly women who looked, considering the facts and listening to the survivor.
She came out, you know, when our story came out, and she remembered I had told her years ago, because she's a great, great friend of mine, and told that I had told her before we had talked.
She's fantastic and has continued to be such a strong, cool voice on so many issues. Rosie O'Donnell was always incredibly principled on this. You know, there were people in the industry who sort of knew and really, I think, understood that there had been a miscarriage of justice. But by and large, it is easier for people to look the other way. I looked the other way for a long time. It really took me as an adult going and looking at those records around the case to understand what had happened there.
And you looked as an attorney brain, too, not just brother.
Yeah. As a lawyer, as a journalist, you know, as someone who looks at a lot of these cases, obviously I'm not an impartial party, but I certainly bring to the table a bunch of skills in terms of assessing the credibility of these kinds of allegations and in terms of coming at them with a note of skepticism. I mean, of course I would have loved for this to be untrue. It would make my life a lot simpler. But unfortunately, I think the preponderance of the evidence suggests otherwise.
So you have a fiance, partner, your partner, John Lovett, leave it to Lovett, love it. We love him. And you guys are crack me up, because when I've seen you on, when you get interviewed together.
Yeah. I'll go on his show occasionally.
It's, you know, funny.
It is funny. He likes to keep a little bit of separation there. I've been saying for years, every time we do something together, there's sort of a chorus of people saying like, they should do a show together, which
you should.
I personally think would be fantastic, but
even 15 minutes, just like just having a conversation. I mean, just, I remember, what was the one you're doing the video game and you're blind watching the video game
in the PSVR.
Oh my gosh, your relationship. But
I think
he's such
a
political voice, and he's so smart. So the two of you together, do you
Well, it's a funny dynamic for that reason, because we do argue a lot, and I think people find that entertaining. And I think there's, you know, there's a nice dynamic there of like him as the outspoken political firebrand and me as the more down the middle reporter, and almost like, you know, the straight man to his antics. I think is something that we should do more of at some point. But he's very rigorous about saying, you know, I don't want to do a Joe and Mika thing. No disrespect to Joe and Mika. For our relationship, do we want that? You know,
to be
out there together professionally in the spotlight all the time. And what effect does that have on a relationship? You know, God bless Joe and Mika for making it work. But I imagine that's a challenge in various ways. I don't know. I say go for it. Let the audience decide. People should harangue him into considering it.
Two of you together, I just you're funny. You're both very funny together. So you're entertaining. The first 6 months of COVID, you were in LA, right?
Yeah.
And lived in a smaller apartment or a house? Small house?
He has a little house in West Hollywood.
Was that hard in the beginning?
You know, we get along pretty well in isolation, actually. We you know, I think like most couples, like you were saying with your own relationship, there's ups and downs, and you definitely, you know, if you're just underfoot all the time with someone, you get on each other's nerves here and there. But I think by and large, especially after an initial adjustment period, we've been pretty disciplined about not squabbling. We're pretty harmonious. He's great, though. I admire him. You know, he's like recording something upstairs now. I admire what he does. I think that, you know, there's an important place for that kind of smart political analysis. I think he's a profoundly ethical person. So while we come at the news cycle in very different ways in our respective bodies of work, you know, I do think he is a really important voice, and I really have a lot of admiration for him.
Can you? I feel very codependent about his diet.
Have you guys talked about that?
No, I've never talked to him about. I feel like I would be a little bit of a nag. I would be his worst nightmare if he was living with me in COVID and eating the way he eats. When he posts this junk food that he eats, I'm so codependent. It makes me really upset and scared for his body,
for his health. He does love junk food, but he also runs a lot. I think he'll be okay.
Does.
I think
oh,
he's.
He does.
I think, yeah, I think he's fairly healthy. But, you know, I want him to be around for a long time, so I want him to stay healthy too. And you know,
there's always great place. Everybody needs to have a little junk food, but not every day. It seems like he posts things like,
maybe I should be a better influence. You know, I don't want to be.
And the Diet Coke thing. Oh, forget it. I'm such a nag with food.
But it's hard in a couple. Cause if you start being a nag about
it's
that,
really
first
bad.
Of all, it's not really my place. Like
you're right.
I don't want to make him feel bad ever. But I also don't want to be enabling anything unhealthy. I mean, I think he is his own worst critic in that respect. You know, I think
just
he stays on his own case.
About people's food. I get worried about it. I think the
thing I worry about more is actually him being too self-critical about things like diet and body image. You know, I think the most important thing in the short term certainly is just that he have like a healthy, you know, mental health situation and self-esteem. And so to me, the bigger worry is actually just preventing him from feeling bad about those kinds of health issues. And so it's a fine balance, right? Because on one level, I think he'll feel better if he, you know, stays as healthy as possible. But on the other hand, I don't want to ever make anyone feel worse by saying like, hey, you should eat healthier.
You know what? This is a good lesson for me to hear the way you're saying it, because I probably should do it that way. But I definitely nag people about help when
I think you can't. The thing is, like, our culture.
It's bad.
Our culture makes people feel so bad anyway, right? About things like junk food and weight and health. You know, all you have to do is check into any social media and, you know, come away after 5 minutes with profound body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just generally operate under the assumption that people are going through their own journey of self, flagellating and feeling terrible about themselves and wanting to be healthier. And I feel like in a couple, the best thing you can do is just, create a situation where you're being supportive and helpful when they come to you and want help, like getting their eating healthy or getting in an exercise routine, but otherwise kind of hang back and just provide
mind your own business
a little bit. Right. Cause otherwise you're just going to be at each other's throats all the time.
Yeah. No wonder. I've been in a fight. No, because my guy smokes cigars. Like it's not it kind of calms him down, but then I'm so focused. No, but your lungs, we got to keep the lungs clear because of COVID.
Yeah.
So
that's a tough one.
I really freak. And I can't be around cigar smoke at all. Cause I'll just go get bronchitis. I'm so,
you know, worried. I feel like there's room probably to have one gentle, constructive conversation where you say, hey, I don't want to be a nag. I really care about your health. And I hope that you're considering the health ramifications. On the other hand, you know, I'm sure he's going through a tough time right now, like everyone else. And maybe he needs that outlet of the cigar to calm him down. So maybe there's a gentle combination of like just making it clear once and then giving him his space.
Oh, it's too late. I've nagged too much. It's like, I just can't bring it up anymore.
No.
It's done. Like, I it's not my business and I don't say anything.
Do we need to do a follow-up to this where you both come on the Zoom and I do a little couples
maybe
counseling?
Maybe. he would love it. He would love it. So tell me, when you have negative stuff at you for what you do, which is your journalism and uncovering
all the time, it pisses
scary stories
off. Yeah.
And people get very angry. And how do you deal with the ramifications of that for yourself?
Not as well as I should. You know, I think I lived for however long it's been since that first Weinstein story. I mean, I was doing contentious investigative stuff beforehand for TV and in other places, but that was really the beginning of a cycle of stories I've still been on where, you know, each one is kind of mortal combat and there's a great incentive for people to shoot the messenger and, you know, a lot of machinery that spins up each time trying to discredit anything I'm doing or come after me legally or again, all the things I've written about in the book. And the, try to avoid any woe is me self-pitying stuff, but I wanted to do that because I think a lot of journalists, especially investigative journalists, deal with versions of that. And you know, I wanted to signal that's a whole system. That's not about any one of us, and you're not alone, anyone else going through that. But I lived in a space of dealing with that as a baseline just level of stress, you know, every day being kind of sleep deprived and sometimes literally physically on the run during those times when I was being followed.
I talked to you once. I was supposed to see you and you just gotten off the plane. We were going to have dinner in New York and I was there for something and you were sick. You were getting the flu. Like you needed to be home in bed. And I was like, wanted to send you soup. You were just really, really wasted.
Yeah. Yeah. There have been a lot of stretches of time where I've just sort of run myself into the ground physically and emotionally and, you know, it doesn't feel great living with that level of stress all the time. And I wish I could say, you know, I let it all roll off my back, because intellectually I certainly know it's part of the job and, that it, you know, should feel like a privilege to be doing work that, creates an impact and inspires that kind of, response. You know, I think generally if, your work is, pissing off people who have been accused credibly of terrible crimes, you're on the right track.
Yeah.
That said, you know, I think I really have been overdue to kind of take a deep breath and work on myself after a period that really kind of could be psychologically shredding. You know, I think that it's hard to make it sustainable to live in that place of stress so much. And, you know, it's I don't want to, again, be self-pitying because I certainly get plenty of, you know, adulation and it's rewarding. You know, I get much more attention than and positive attention than a whole lot of my peers in journalism. And I'm very conscious of that, you know, peers who are doing incredibly important consequential work. But, you know, stress is real and anxiety is real. And you know, the fact that journalists who are targeted by those kinds of tactics, you know, do experience it taking a toll is real. So I've started talking a little more openly about that in a way that I hope is about something other than my own issues.
But even having a therapist to download this stuff with, because I think we're all collectively so anxious anyway, and then on top of it, the intense, life-threatening sometimes work you do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. Like, you know, I've done work in Afghanistan and other conflict zones and been around, you know, the kind of frontline workers in those settings who are really facing threats to their physical safety every day on a much more acute level. But yes, getting death threats and legal threats and being chased around and approached by people using false identities to try to extract information. I mean, all of that is does take a toll over time.
Did you have that to people that were pretended to be something that they weren't?
Yeah, I mean, that's all that's laid out in the book. That's part of the tactics. So, you know, I try to strike a balance between keeping it in perspective and also...
That woman that did that with Rose.
That Black Cube agent. There's plenty of that happens. I'm working on a story right now that involves some of that. And when it comes at you personally, it can absolutely take a toll. I guess... The thing that I would say is I'm just out there keeping my head down, trying to do the work the best I can. And I try to not let the noise, either the kind of the positive attention or the attacks get in the way of that. You know, and it's ultimately it's a pretty simple old fashioned thing that I'm trying to do of investigative journalism. And, you know, my job is to do it as carefully and meticulously as possible. And thankfully in everything I do, I have an incredible team around me at the New Yorker and at HBO, and everything is, you know, surrounded by layers of editors with really good judgment and fact checkers who are on the side of caution. And, you know, it's easy to make journalists a target, but ultimately it's about the underlying facts. And I hope I can continue to expose important underlying facts.
I feel like that you never took a break. Like you literally have not stopped for what, 5 years? I mean, like a long time since, you know, everything that was happening in NBC and you have uncovering the Matt Lauer stuff on top of it, all of this, you have not stopped. And have you ever thought,
I always go to pains, by the way, to make sure credit is assigned where due. I did not break the Matt Lauer story. Matt Lauer was first accused of sexual assault, serious sexual assault, in the New York Times, actually, about a year before I ever turned to that issue.
But you did uncover the cover-ups of all of that.
Yes, yes. You know, I was fortunate to have a bunch of people around that story talk to me and flesh out our understanding of it further. But it was, you know, that's one where my contribution was incremental. And there were a whole group of great reporters, several reporters at Variety, Elizabeth Wagmeister and Ramin Setudeh were two of the reporters there who worked on that. There's been a lot of people, as with most of these stories, that sort of built out our understanding and revealed a lot of important things. But yes, you know, it has been a period, to your point, of you know, one large scale, quite taxing story after another. And I mostly feel really fortunate to have been able to maintain that pace, but also I am deliberately trying to give myself time to, you know, attain equilibrium and do some healing in between.
I think that's good, Ronan. Yeah, because if you're not, there's so many stories to tell, there's a lot and people really need you, but in order for you to do it in the way that you do and put your all into it, it's like, it's okay to take a couple months, like really off, like really, really. But I don't see you ever doing that.
I'm like, trying. I mean, I haven't allowed myself enough. I think you're right. I wrapped up the podcast, the Catch and Kill podcast, this spring, February, mm-hmm. March, and then.
Went into lockdown.
Right. Then we went into lockdown, and I've thankfully been able to continue work on the documentaries during that period, and also worked on a number of stories over the summer. One of which, as I said, just launched this whistleblower story, which was something that consumed the better part of a year. And there were a couple of other big political stories, which, you know, may yet see the light of day at some point. And I'm launching a slate of new investigations now. But I
think I just almost don't want to bug you with the stuff, but I think I need to.
Yeah, no, please. I always welcome more leads, and that goes for anyone listening to if you're this part of it. It's, you know, I very often am able to get on the trail of something real because someone writes in, you know, particularly if you possess documents or proof of something or, you know, a firsthand account of something important, you know, write to me and let's see if I can look into it if it's newsworthy. You know, I feel bad sometimes because I can't take on every story, but if you've got something newsworthy that I can't take on, I generally try to pass it to another reporter. There are a lot of good people who can look at a whole range of different issues depending on what you're talking about. But yeah, I take your point well, and I do think at some point I may have to take a bit of a break and step back.
Being home though with your mom and being at the family home, is that healing? Just being there?
Yes, it's been wonderful to spend some time with her. You know, it's just me and
she was
John
alone
is here.
Yeah.
She was alone for a long stretch. I mean, she does have, there's two of my siblings who live in the neighborhood.
So she has little grandbabies.
She has grandbabies around, and one of those families has elected to kind of be in a bubble with her. You know, they don't send the kids to school, and they don't have interaction with the outside world. And everyone is, you know, tested routinely and doesn't really have any contact with anyone. So, you know, people have been careful here, I think, as people should be right now.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful. I realize many people are completely isolated and have it much worse in that respect. And I've been thankful to be able to see family during this time a bit. Are you with, you're with your husband?
My daughter was with us the first couple months. She was with us. She had a breakup, moved in with her cat. And that was, I could just make a series just on that.
Yeah.
It was intense. But she's amazing.
She should. She's so charismatic. I would watch that.
She's so great.
Great.
But, you know, it's been challenging for her and all her friends. You know, it's been a lot. But do you think that since Catch and Kill, how has the media culture changed? Do you think it has at all?
You know, I'm probably not the best equipped to say. You know, I'm not a day-to-day media reporter. I certainly think there's a greater understanding of the challenges to bringing complicated and contentious investigative stories to light, not just because of Catch and Kill, but because of a whole set of revelations of the last few years. And, you know, I hope that further empowers reporters. You know, I've definitely heard from reporters at a variety of outlets, including ones that I've reported on, like NBC and CBS, you know, that they feel like there's more space for them to do what they have to do professionally when they're reporting on tough stories because of the events of the last few years. And I hope that that's the case.
Honan, I wish I could talk to you for a long time. I really want to, will you tell your mom I want to do this with her?
I will.
I would love.
You guys should do it.
We definitely got to do a Mia Farrow.
And we've got to set something up for you guys to do together. I hate hearing that job that you liked fell through.
Oh, this is the thing. Her and I should do something like the Children's Hour-esque, you know, something like that.
I don't know what the project is, but we should find something. And,
I mean, we're too old for that, but it's like that kind of story, two women in a setting, you know, dealing with stuff, and it could be great.
I mean, I, as a viewer, would love to see more of both of you on screen, and together would be a delight too. And I think I speak for a lot of people out there when I say that. And there are so many fabulous directors who, you know, have come up to me and talked about wanting to see more of both of you. It's got to be possible. If there's not a project out there right now, it's got to be possible to set one up.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
But just would probably have to be, you know, independently made in the way things are. That's the one thing we're seeing is that we don't have to be reliant on studio system, right? This is changing things.
People are just making their art. Find the right property. Yeah. Find a great book that's coming down the pike or a script that hasn't been produced with the right parts for you guys, and let's make it happen.
Are you writing the screenplay to Catch as Kill?
You know, I think I've seen authors take two different approaches to these sorts of things. Either they're very hands-on and they really try to stay involved, or they just say, you know, go with God and, you know, the chips will fall wherever they may. I think for me, what happens there, if anything, I'm certainly not in a rush to adapt that. I've been very fortunate to have people call wanting to adapt that.
It makes the greatest movie. It would.
I think it could be an important story to bring to a different and wider audience someday. But I think for me, whether that happens and how it happens, including the question you asked of, like, am I involved or am I totally not involved, depends entirely on the right creative hands. You know, I think if the right writer or the right director has the right idea for it.
Did you ever have that meeting with my friend Jay Roach?
You know, I have talked to Jay a few times. I ran into him. I think he came to a taping.
I think he would do a great job with this.
A show that I was on. And yeah, I had a fabulous conversation with him. And he's the loveliest guy. You know, I've been fortunate to have a couple of conversations with filmmakers that I really admire who were interested in doing something. And I think, you know, I'm just taking it slow on those kinds of conversations about any work that I've done and really wanting to make sure that if I decide to do anything at all there, it's because there is some kismet creative match and I'm really putting it in the right hands. You know, hopefully where I don't have to be involved then, you know, cause it's such a sure set of hands with such a clear vision for it that I can just step back.
Well, I think our time is up and thank you so much, Ronan, for being here with me and, love you guys. Love, give my love to John and, I won't nag him about his food.
I will. And, my mom sends love to you. Everyone here sends love to your family. And, I hope you get past, cigar nagging gate.
I'm done. I already stopped it. Yeah. I stopped the cigar. I gave up it up. Yeah. It's just, I don't know what it is. It's just,
Oh no, I get it. It's from sincere.
I'm the eldest. I'm a mag. I just, I don't know what it is.
I get it.
I'm a nag.
I send you a hug. Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Lots of love. Bye, honey.
Bye, Rosanna.
Bye.
Hey everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review Radical Musings to help other listeners find the show and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast to be alerted every time we post a new episode. Radical Musings is brought to you by Audio Up, produced by Krista Liney and Carla Braun, edited by Jeremiah Zimmerman, production support provided by Ashley Ardent, Sam Winter, Tyler Dorson, Emma Rappold, and Richard Regal. Thank you all so much.
Hi, I've got a prescription for diabetes test strips. How much is the copay?
That could take me a while to calculate. In the meantime, you should think about over-the-counter ContourNex test strips. You get 35 for $19.99, and they're highly accurate. For full details, visit ContourNex.com/radio.